Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Attorney Susan B. Jordan, a good friend and colleague, died tragically in a small plane crash on Friday, May 29, 2009, in southern Utah. Susan's death is a big loss. Susan Jordan and I first met in the summer of 1970, working for a legal services program dedicated to developing legal strategies to change unconstitutional and unfair laws. We met again and became friends when she moved to Mendocino County in the late 1980s. We worked together here on many projects, the last being strategies to defeat the proposed Ukiah Mall project on the Mendocino County ballot this fall, 2009. In this edition of Radio Curious, dedicated to the memory of Susan B. Jordan, we'll hear portions of a Radio Curious interview with Susan Jordan recorded on April 25, 1996, and thoughts about her life from attorneys Steve Antler and Ann Moorman, as well as Judge David Nelson. Here's Susan B. Jordan, recorded April 25, 1996.
Well, good morning, Barry. How are you? I'm speaking from Oakland, but you know as well as everyone else that my principal office is in Ukiah.
An active person in the Mendocino County Bar Association.
And the Women's Bar Association.
And that's what the topic of our program this morning is about. The effect that women attorneys have had on the legal system in the past 26 years since Susan Jordan and I have both been attorneys trying to fight for justice and overcome evil. Susan, what, in your experience, has been that effect?
Well, you're probably going to have to help me with this list because it is so long. But in my opinion and experience, I guess it's more than an opinion at this point, women have so changed the face and the color and the fabric of the law that it's almost unrecognizable. And what I mean by that is the decisions in the area of sex discrimination, sex harassment, rights for children, the battered wife defenses, just about everything that affects women because of women lawyers principally, has now come into the law when before there simply were these rights for women were not there.
They were just not there.
They were just not there. Rape victims, for example, got treated horribly in court. In fact, one of our biggest first pushes in the law was to, we had to start with the police officers, but we had to teach police that when women came in, and if they came in and said they were raped, that they should believe them. That, I mean, that's how primitive things were. And then we had to teach the judges that, and then we had to change the law to accommodate that view.
In changing the law, you had to change the instructions that the judge gave to the jury.
First we had to change the judge's mind, and then we had to go to the legislature and change the instructions that they would give to jurors. What they used to do when, and it was very rare, women would not complain, or they would not be complainants in rape cases. They would not go to the police because they felt, and they were right, that they would be disbelieved, so why bother? But the law, when those cases got to court, the judge used to read the jury an instruction at the end of the case, which said to the jurors, in evaluating the evidence against the rape defendant, the person accused of rape, the judge used to say, be compelled to say, rape is a charge easily made or easily brought, but hard to disprove. And that really gave a leg up to the defendant because, in fact, that isn't true. Rape is not a charge easily brought, easy to disprove. So it was just backwards. We needed to equalize it and say, okay, rape is a charge like anything else, and it's not any more easily brought by a woman than is a charge of an accusation of burglary or robbery. And we did get the law changed, and women now go to court, and if the defendant's guilty, he's found guilty, and if he's not, he's acquitted.
Why don't you tell what you did to change that law in the Inez Garcia case?
I'll talk about the Inez Garcia case. It did not have the effect of changing that law.
but it had the effect of raising the consciousness.
It had the effect of raising the consciousness. Inez Garcia was a woman who was living in Salinas, and she was living in Salinas because her husband, they were not from the area, her husband was in prison. There's a prison there, and her husband was in prison there, and she was living nearby to visit with him. And she was living in the house, basically a roommate. This sounds hard to believe, but in the dark ages of the 1960s and early 70s, a woman living with a roommate, male roommate, was kind of unheard of. It was true, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Women did not have male roommates, and
absolutely.
So there was this kind of connotation of, well, there must be something, you know, dirty, sleazy going on if they have a male roommate. So that was the first problem I suffered, was that kind of bias against women who had male roommates, and that was her only option. There were no rooms in this town. She didn't have a lot of money, and I think this guy was her third or fourth cousin or something, Freddie Medrano. And one night, Freddie left the house, and Inez was home alone, and some kind of friends of Freddie's came over, and they got drunk, and they took Inez, two of them, one of them weighed over 300 pounds, took her out back and raped her. One watched, and I think the big guy watched, and the other one raped her. And then they left, and she went back in the house, and she was totally traumatized. And the phone rang, and it was the accomplice, not the rapist, calling to say, they were laughing, and they were bragging, and they said, well, next time we'll do worse to you. And they were laughing it up and yucking it up. And she sat around for a while, and the more she sat around there, the more she got scared. So she left the house, and she took with her the only weapon in the house, which was Freddie's shotgun. And she walked down the street with his shotgun in a daze, really not knowing what to do. It didn't occur to her to call the police.
And this was within about 45 minutes after the rape?
This was within 45 minutes. And she never would have called the police. Once she was mortified. And in those days, and to some extent a lot now, women are very ashamed of having been raped, as if it is our fault. But she was ashamed, and she had no clue, no thought the police would believe her. And so she went down the street. She was ultimately going to go to her sister's, and she's walking down the street, and she comes upon, again, this 300-pound man, Miguel Jimenez, the accomplice to the rapist. And he's in another fight, this time with a man. And he turns, and he has a knife in his hand, and he turns towards her. And before he has a chance to do what he said on the phone was, do worse to you, she shoots him and kills him.
And about the only thing worse would be murder.
Exactly. Now, that's something also that was unknown in the law. Rape was not considered a crime of violence, believe it or not. They defined robbery and burglary and assault, but they did not define rape as a crime of violence. Rape was seen as something, well, you know, that actually, it was seen as giving a woman a good time. And Inez had two trials. In her first trial, I was not her lawyer, and she was convicted. And one of the jurors was interviewed afterwards, and they said to him, they said, well, why did you convict her? And he said, you know, you can't kill someone for just trying to give you a good time. And those were the prevailing attitudes about women who were raped, that, oh, well, you know, the guy was trying to give you a good time, you know, no problem.
And then you had that conviction overturned on appeal.
I had that conviction overturned. I took the case on appeal, and then on our second trial, our ultimate defense was that Inez acted in self-defense, that later on, after he said he was going to do worse to her, the only thing she could believe was that he was going to kill her, and when he had a knife in his hand, it looked absolutely like he was going to kill her. But in order to get there, we had to do a lot of work with the jury and the judge in terms of overcoming these stereotypes about rape victims, you know, asking for it. Everybody thought that, you know, a rape victim asks for it. That it just isn't, it wasn't seen as a crime of violence. And Inez was a very kind of flashy, sexy-looking Cuban lady. And, you know, the jurors, but they could have looked at her and said, oh, this gal asked for it. Living alone in that, you know, living in that town with a male roommate, she's asking for it. Which was the furthest thing from the truth. But we had to ask all the jurors about that. We had to tell the judge about it. We had to do a lot of kind of background work before the jury was willing to see her as truly a victim. The first question everybody had was, well, why didn't she go to the police? And it's interesting. I was in Cambodia this fall working. I was teaching trial lawyers, and we talked about this case, and, you know, it's so universal. That's just what they said. They said, well, why didn't she call the police? Even though in their country, the women wouldn't go to the police. People are intimidated by doctors, police, people with power, and women who are not used to, I find this all the time, you know, clients look at me and they say, well, how can you speak like that in court? Isn't it scary? And I say, yeah, it used to be really scary, and I still get scared. So it's very hard to speak up in an environment where the person you're speaking to is more articulate, has a lot of power, and you're not just speaking to them, you're trying to convince them. Because in a rape case, the presumption used to be, oh, you weren't really raped, you were just trying to have a good time. I have to say, things have changed. I mean, some of the first people to come around were, in fact, were law enforcement. Early on, they started having these courses for law enforcement officers about how to listen to rape victims. They gave them statistics, they gave them all the real truth, and some of the first people to come around and help rape victims, as it should be, were law officers, male and female. And slowly the world, not just through law cases, but there were a lot of movies on TV at that point, TV movies about rape victims. It was really part of the larger women's movement, and the laws began to change.
In both the San Francisco Bay Area and in Mendocino County, do you see a difference between, well, let's say, the police in responding to rape situations?
You know, I don't know enough to generalize. I can say individually at this point in time, there are numbers of law enforcement officers who are very enlightened about this issue. And there are numbers who are absolutely backward, you know, with sexist attitudes towards women and sexist attitudes towards rape.
There's another question that I wanted to talk about with you, and that's the concept of hate crimes, which is a new developing area in the law, just as the protection of rape victims was 20 years ago and the beginning of the civil rights movement was 30 years ago. I see the concept of rape as a hate crime.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see it beginning to be prosecuted or presented in court in that fashion?
Well, that's novel. No, I've never seen that.
Because it seems to me within the next 15, 20 years, perhaps it can.
Hatred against women.
Yeah, it seems to me that the sociological studies of people who rape are expressing that hatred.
Well, it really is true. In preparation for this program, I was thinking, okay, so what are people going to ask? And I know, I'm going to put it to rest right now, someone's going to want to call up and say, well, men get raped too.
Mm-hmm.
And that, occasionally a man gets raped, is true, rarely. But the crime is really directed against women. The only crime that I can think of that is exclusively directed in its motivation and its attitudes and its power and its whatever against women, even though it's true occasionally a man is raped. It's analogous to the hate crimes, but I've never seen it used that way.
You're listening to Radio Curious and a special memorial program in honor of attorney Susan B. Jordan, who died in the crash of a small plane in southern Utah on May 29, 2009. I'm Barry Vogel. Judge David Nelson visited the studios of Radio Curious on June 2, 2009, to share his thoughts about Susan.
I've known her ever since she came to the county as a lawyer who moved to Laytonville, actually lived out in the woods like many of us did in a little cabin. Came here on weekends primarily, but decided she liked it so much that she went and stayed just like many of the others of us.
We've heard a lot about her professional work. Tell us about her non-professional work.
She loved the outdoors, the land, nature. She was a fierce advocate as a lawyer. We did a lot of cases together. But she also had this whole other side to her that initially nature-based, later she got into gardening, and most recently yoga and meditation were her real passion. She really put her whole intelligence and her energy into learning about yoga and being able to teach it, and also meditation in her own life, I think, to kind of balance some of the aggressive edge she had as a lawyer. She was looking for ways to balance that and understand that.
You were co-counsel with her on many cases.
We did many cases together. We kind of balanced, maybe, because, as I say, she was a fierce advocate.
And you weren't?
And I was a little more on the quiet side of persuasion. She was a great advocate, and those who hired her had to pay a lot to get her. But she also did a whole lot of cases for free for people, for causes she believed in. The first one I remember is the Liz Irwin. When Liz Irwin, long time ago, this must go back into the early 80s, but there was a dispute over whether who had been elected supervisor in Fort Bragg, and Liz Irwin was a more of a progressive member, and the balance of the board was in contention at the time, and she represented Liz on the legal aspects of upholding the election results, which I think is one or two votes or something. And since then, she's done other cases, the GMO case and representing the old Ukiah Cannabis Club, all these things for free.
With Susan B. Jordan gone from the legal community here in Mendocino County and on a broader statewide and national scale, what will we miss? What did you see in her as co-counsel, a friend, and a judge that you don't see in other attorneys?
She was always breaking barriers, and she was a real leader initially as a woman lawyer, but most recently, as I say, in yoga and meditation, she was part of a national organization, really, but locally based, also trying to spread the knowledge of meditation as it might affect lawyers in their practice or judges in their practice. So she was always out on the edge and the kind of person you always expected to be there. Now that she's gone, our relationship with her changes, obviously, but I think she will always be there as a teacher.
Dave, you remember how when she was in the courtroom, Susan Jordan had an uncanny ability to take control of the courtroom, sometimes to the frustration of the judge.
Yeah, that's right. I practiced with her for many years and watched her control the courtroom. It was charisma, but also her intelligence. She knew how to do it, and she could do it. So it was great as a lawyer. As a judge, it was a different experience. I did a one-week trial with her, and I did some other cases with her in my courtroom, and it's a little different experience there. She was beyond control from the judge. Gentle persuasion wouldn't stop her if she was going down a road she wanted to go. And
what did she do?
It was a matter of positioning. It was a matter of tone of voice. It was a matter of the ideas that she pursued and the relationship she had with the prosecutor and the witness and the jurors. She wanted to be in control. She was often in control, and it was to her advantage most generally. But if you're trying to manage a trial and get it done in 3 days, for instance, when she's not about to be managed, it was a different experience.
When you say positioning, where she would stand in the courtroom?
Where she would stand, how and when she would stand with respect to where the jurors were, with respect to the witness, with respect to the prosecutor.
And that's very hard to control as a judge.
It is. We have some basic rules. And it's not that she was outside the bounds of our rules. It was just that she had a way of the keeping the spotlight directed where she wanted it.
Attorney Steve Antler of the Mendocino Coast was also a friend of Susan Jordan. I spoke with him from his home on June 1st, 2009.
Susan, you know, was an attorney's attorney. She was the attorney that attorneys turn to as an expert, as someone to look up to, as someone to involve in their more complicated cases. She was known to everyone for her expertise and her abilities in the courtroom and in analyzing legal problems. I've turned to her on several occasions. She was a profound person, and she believed in people taking action and participating and being active in a way that was comfortable for them and in a way that had an impact. And I think it's so important. You know, she's another example of what one person can do if they put their minds to it and try and do things. There's a kind of an air, oh, I can't do anything. I can't have any impact. I'm frustrated. What can one person do? And then we see someone like Susan who did so much in so many different ways and at the same time had a very happy life, a very full life, a family, a garden, traveled, you know, had a lot of fun, and at the same time made huge impacts in the law and in the law of the state and people's lives. So I think she's a wonderful example for us.
Ukiah attorney Ann Moorman, a close friend and colleague of Susan Jordan for many years, visited Radio Curious on June 1st, 2009.
I met Susan Jordan when I graduated from law school and went out into the world to try to practice criminal defense. I met her through somebody else, and went to work for her directly with her law partner at the time, and became lifelong friends from that day forward. And she was my teacher. She taught me how to be a criminal defense lawyer and be a woman and be a compassionate human being all at the same time. And who she is so hard to really capture her entirely, so I'm actually not even going to try. But I will say she's evolved. At that time when I met her, you know, she was already well along, that was 1986, well along in her career as a historical, person of historical importance already in being an advocate for women, in particular women accused of violent crimes. Her success in getting the battered women's syndrome defense to be recognized as a defense, a mental state defense for women who were battered and because of it committed violent crimes, but also a champion for many other people who had been persecuted and investigated by the government during the anti-war movement, during Vietnam and in the wake of Vietnam. The plethora of grand jury abuses that were perpetrated by the government in exploiting the terror visited upon people when they receive a grand jury subpoena and the inquisitorial nature of those proceedings, especially at that time. She and others stood up vigorously in much at their own peril to represent those people. So she was already at that time when I met her had really already established herself as a person, a lawyer of historical proportion. We know that was 1986 and we're 23 years later and she's done an enormous amount of things since then. I do think it's important for people to realize that she started practicing law after having been a school teacher. And she learned a lot about people and being curious about people, which you'll appreciate because you're curious, as a school teacher. And she got, of course, inspired and motivated by the anti-war movement and the freedom of speech movement, and turned to the law and went to law school in Chicago at Northwestern, and then joined a law collective in Chicago and met lifelong friends, established lifelong principles. She also became a very famous and very effective advocate at a time when women in the courtroom were virtually unheard of. Susan Jordan's career spanned the days when she would walk through the courtroom doors and the bailiff would approach her and say, "Missy, please have a seat over here," assuming she was someone's daughter or girlfriend or friend and needed to sit in the gallery. But she boldly would step through the doors of what we call the well in the courtroom. And judges were not used to seeing women. They were not used to seeing women wearing pants. They weren't used to hearing from women who spoke forcefully and aggressively and articulately. And she lived and thrived, albeit not without struggle. She plays a very important role for people like me and women lawyers coming after me as being a hero and a role model, but really a model that even if you didn't know her, if you ever watched her once in court, or if you ever read an article about her, or if you ever saw her interviewed on TV or heard her on the radio, people would remember her because of her extraordinarily poignant and vivid personal power, and that she could tap into her personal power for the benefit of others. Sometimes they were individuals. Sometimes it's a group like women who have been subjected to sexual harassment or battery or being discriminated against in the workplace. Susan Jordan is a person that had lived her whole life, you know, never wasting a moment. That doesn't mean she never reflected, and because she did reflect. She was very thoughtful in the sense of not just being sensitive to other people's feelings, but she was very thoughtful about what she did and what the impact of what she might say or what she might do or not do. She always was thinking about the consequences. And I mean that in the personal environment, and I mean it in the professional environment, because she did have extraordinary personal power. She was very reflective and considerate about how she used it. And what I have been reflecting about lately is, like all of us, you know, she evolved and she was an evolving person and an evolving spirit. And so many people think of her as that champion and that warrior in the courtroom and the warrior for the liberties of people everywhere. But as you know, Barry, she also was a yoga practitioner. Well, it's a big piece of who she is her devotion, or lifelong, decades-long devotion to the practice of yoga as a becoming an instructor and incorporating yoga practices and Zen practices into her daily habits and into her daily interactions with other people. You know, people really need to understand that in this body of such a strong and articulate and often combative person was also the soul of a very inquisitive and peaceful and, you know, gentle soul. She had a creative side of her that came out in her gardening and her cooking, and her general inquisitive nature, you know, took her far beyond the legal profession, which is something I really hope your listeners can appreciate about this person who made such great strides in the law for individuals and for women and for women professionals. But that was just a part of who she was and who she is. And she'll continue to be this very strong motivating force in my life and in all of those of us who were fortunate enough to know her. But I know there's lots of people that are listening that don't know her but have heard about her or heard something about her. And she's every bit as magical as the stories suggest.
We conclude this memorial to attorney Susan B. Jordan with the question about a favorite book that I asked her on April 25th, 1996.
Oh, I read a wonderful book. I read this book called Bird by Bird.
Oh, yes.
Which has nothing to do with any of this, or it has completely to do with it. It's a book about becoming a writer, but it's also a book about becoming yourself, doing what impassions you. My kid keeps asking, what should I be? You know, how will I make money, and what will be a good job? And I keep saying to her, she says, oh, Mom, that's so corny. But what I keep saying is, do what your heart tells you. Do what turns you on. I see my work as an absolute expression of my beliefs and my concerns, and I'm very privileged to be able to do that. Not a lot of people can do that.
I remember attending a yoga class that Susan Jordan taught many years ago. She began the class by saying, "This is a special time. This class is for you, for your enjoyment and pleasure, however you may wish it to be, because you have control of what you may do with it." Life is that way too, she said, not just this class. Attorney and friend Susan B. Jordan died in the crash of a small plane on May 29, 2009 in southern Utah. The book she recommended during our interview is Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. This program is available on our website. That's radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.